Welcome to Grand Heron International's Let's Rumble, Let's Ramble, our monthly live broadcast where two of our professional coaches select a relevant and thought-provoking topic to rumble over. And of course, we broadcast that live on LinkedIn, YouTube, and Facebook. But if you're listening to this episode, it's because it's been converted into an audio podcast for your listening pleasure. We hope that you will enjoy today's topic.
Hi, everyone, and welcome. Marella De Civita here, and you are listening to Let's Rumble, recorded live September 15, 2022. This is our third episode, and today we are addressing a very oftenly asked question. Is there more psychopathology in the business world? Joining me here today is Natalie Duray, a professional certified coach, a mentor coach, a coaching supervisor, as well as a learning specialist, a strategist, and an ex-corporate executive. She knows the business world inside and out. Welcome, Natalie.
Thanks.
So it would seem appropriate to think that in the last few years, there has been a surge of interest in psychopathology in the workplace. One well-known researcher, Robert Hare, stated something of this: not all psychopaths are in prison, some are in the boardroom. This was a response to a question he was asked by a reporter back in 2002. That's 20 years ago. The public's fascination with psychopathology has continued and it has been pretty widespread. Here's another interesting fact. The concept of business psychopathology first received widespread attention in the late 1990s. Following a very specific case written by a researcher and picked up by media. And of course, there is no shortage of descriptors. I've actually heard people say things such as snakes in suits. And I think that might be a book title. Natalie, anything you want to add here?
Yeah, actually, snakes in suits is from Robert Hare.
Okay. Yeah.
And you know, while I was prepping for this, I did a quick Google search and I found over 300 books on psychopaths in the boardroom and corporate world. And there's even one called How to Use Your Inner Psychopath for Good. So it's certainly capturing the imagination and people are really, really interested. And you know, when you think about the ideal CEO, I saw this description that, you know, everyone would want to have someone. I don't know. Do we have time to read it?
Oh, yes. Go. Let's do it.
So an ideal CEO is a charismatic leader who inspires people to follow them, a strategic thinker who can master the details, a tireless worker with incredible focus and problem-solving skills. They are well-liked by their employees, but also able to make and execute unpopular decisions. Above all, they are an exceptional communicator who can convey a vision to any audience from Wall Street to the most junior employee. So I don't know, but we're, you know, is there more psychopathology in the business world than anywhere else?
Yeah. So let's go and see what the evidence tells us. I think first, you and I both agree that we need to get clear as to what it is that we're talking about. Psychopathology versus psychopathy. And so here's some of the things that we do want our listeners to know. There is a difference in that psychopathology is used in medical and psychology circles to talk about the etiology, development, evolution of mental and behavioral disorders, whereas psychopathy is a clinical construct that is used to describe subclinical maladaptive behavioral patterns. And that is really what we are going to be focusing on, is subclinical. No one is saying that these are diagnoses by any stretch of the imagination, but it does touch four features that chances are that we actually can talk about later on that people have actually experienced, and that is distorted thinking patterns, problematic emotional responses, under-controlled impulse control, and impersonal difficulties. So when we refer to psychopathy, this is not a clinical diagnosis of any kind, as I said, and we are looking at the subclinical presentation of certain behaviors. I should also mention that psychopathy is a part of what most researchers will refer to as the dark triad. And it actually includes narcissism and also Machiavellian. So bear with me for just a little while longer. Narcissism, so subclinical presentation of behavioral patterns, has to do with a sense of superiority, lack of empathy, and arrogant. And of course, We then go to psychopathy. And here we are looking at callous, superficial charm, lack of anxiety, remorse, empathy as well, poor impulse control, irresponsibility, and legal, or should I say more of the deviant kind, total disrespect for legal and moral rules and regulations. The last one, the Machiavellian, that is part of this dark triad, is cynical, calculated. And then we have someone who has good impulse control, goal-oriented, exceptionally great at strategic long-term planning. This one, however, doesn't have a clinical correlate. In other words, we just look at these traits and we're not talking about what happens when these traits surpass subclinical and is there a disorder attached to Machiavellian? And the answer is no. Is there a disorder attached to psychopathy over and above subclinical levels? And the answer is yes. Both psychopathy above clinical levels is antisocial personality. Narcissism above clinical levels, we're looking at narcissistic personality disorder. And I think what I want to say here, because part of the answer lies in how it is defined, is that narcissistic, antisocial, borderline, and histrionic is part of cluster B of personality disorders. So without further ado, the answer, after Natalie and I reviewed several empirical studies looking at the prevalence of a psychopathy, corporate psychopathy, is inconclusive.
So just to make sure I'm understanding the terms subclinical, so we're saying that someone could display some behaviors that could be called callous or self-aggrandizing. Some of the terms that you were mentioned, superficial charm. Yeah. But I think there's a big distinction that sometimes is someone detailed oriented, or they sometimes they get labeled as OCD, right, or is someone ambitious? Or so I think that that's really the key that I'm hearing you saying, is that someone could be having some behaviors, but they're not necessarily traits.
And they're not necessarily above subclinical levels. And we get to above subclinical levels, then we are looking at diagnoses. And only a trained professional clinician can actually confer a diagnosis. And therefore, that's not what we're talking about. However, it's important to underscore that the evidence is inconclusive for obvious reasons. I think it's going to start to sound more obvious as we go about it. The first one has to do with, well, what exactly are we comparing what we find to? In other words, clarity around prevalence rates in the general population, as well as our target audience, which is, for instance, the corporate environment executives. Let me give you an example. Some latest statistics here in Quebec, I think the study is 2021, I can get the reference later, shows that the lifetime prevalence of cluster B, now remember, cluster B of personality disorder includes narcissistic personality disorder, antisocial personality disorder, histrionic, what's the third one? Antisocial, narcissistic, histrionic, and I'm forgetting one. Borderline. So the prevalence rate of cluster B in the Quebec population is 2.6. This means 208,000 citizens have experienced in their lifetime, have been conferred this diagnosis, right? So now if we're going to have a look at Quebec companies and how many Quebec companies and look at their executives, we would have to decide, what are we really measuring, subclinical or clinical? And so that brings me to the second, right? Very difficult to get populations to want to agree to a study of this nature, even if we're looking at subclinical traits. Very difficult. And so what most researchers have done is that they've used these mega databases, online internet surveys, like the Amazon's Mechanical Turk, for instance. So they go in and they take data from individuals across the spectrum, across the board, who are being paid to complete these assessments and so forth. So once again, what prevalence rate are we going to use? Mm-hmm. Are we going to use the cluster B, which is diagnoses? And then would corporate executives want to be diagnosed? And what is the basis of the ethical implications of doing that.
And who's likely to complete these surveys?
Who's likely to complete the surveys, correct. Yeah. And I think you and I both had, we were both fascinated when we learned that there are many ways to look at subclinical traits of psychopathy. And here are just some of the tools that you and I discovered. Psychopathy checklist, which again is a clinical construct on scales, and it does require clinical interview, very difficult to do. Again, we have the screening one, which is a lot easier to do, but you know, I ask you, would you feel comfortable saying that you come across as smooth, polished, and at the same time have no regrets on the decisions you've made with your company? A little bit harder to do. There's also the business scan 360 that is used. And then I like this one, the Dirty Dozen, which again has a lot more to do with the dark triad. So now it's also measuring Machiavellian, it's measuring a narcissism and psychopathy. In the general prevalence that I just referred to, that is not what happened. In the general prevalence study here in Quebec, they actually looked at conferred diagnosis of personality disorder. So even at this, very difficult to do. So we concluded that there are actually two studies we felt were good enough and still not without their limitations. The first study back in 2010 found that their corporate sample had more employees scoring higher on those psychopathy measures that I just talked about compared to a community sample. Careful, community sample in this case was just the general population and not necessarily the general population of where these executives lived. Sample size was very small, and one of the investigators was actually a consultant in the company. The second study, more recent, 2021, compared a specific executive group, I think they were the supply chain management department, and a business sample to a community sample, and they found higher levels of psychopathy in both the executive and the business sample. But here again, the differences were small, and they really touched upon certain subclinical traits of fearlessness. Small, and that's all I will say, is small.
Yeah, it's easy to, when you hear the results, to extrapolate. And from looking at the sample size and looking at the quality of the research, is really something that we need to pay more attention to in the general population.
Right. And I think the other thing that you and I also agreed with is what happens when we walk around as human beings and we say, oh yeah, that's got to be, that's got to be psychopathy, or oh, that definitely is narcissistic personality. There's got to be some kind of disorder there. Something happens. Yeah.
I find it's it kind of makes it an easy way out, because whenever we label someone as, oh, they're a psychopath, we're kind of removing their responsibility and also the possibility of change. And it also removes some of our power in that I can't do anything, or it creates also fear. And so if calling someone a psychopath brings along the conversation of addressing behaviors, I mean, that's different. But just labeling someone and just, you know, kind of throwing the towel, that there's nothing we can do about it. I think that's where there's a mistake in using the label.
Yeah. I think the other thing that comes to mind as I'm hearing you say just how important it is, this empowering element, is what exactly does happen in corporate life? You know, what are some of the structures that are in place that bring out some deviant behaviors in some people more than others? Where are the accountability measures around certain behaviors? You know, we started off with you reading a description of a CEO. Do you mind telling us where that one came from?
Well, actually, there was a punchline to that. So it would seem that this would be an ideal CEO, but it's actually a descriptor, a portrait of a corporate psychopath provided by a law enforcement officer. You know, there were a lot of scandals around lying and cheating and stealing, and so a lot of work was done, and that's actually a profile. So on the surface, it seems great, but when you add pressures and no accountability and no limits, this is where people that might have tendencies have a way out. But by creating reward systems or performance measurement systems that take into account the behaviors that we don't want, more and more there are organizations putting in place as civility training or zero tolerance in terms of Canada is great around the new harassment law. Mm-hmm. And so often we hear of creating psychologically safe spaces, and that's actually going to be our next on October 20th. So I find that, you know, there are some ways that we can put in place some measures to limit some of these behaviors.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I wonder if we have any questions from our audience.
Feel free to let us know. Oh, here's an anonymous question comment from YouTube. I have more of a comment than a question. In all honesty, I continue to suffer in my workplace. Yeah, so, okay, so we've said that there are not more, psychopathology is not proven to be more prevalent in the workplace, but yet there are, these behaviors are present and people are noticing them and people are suffering. And so, you know, so now what?
Right.
So I have a lot of compassion for people that are suffering because of these behaviors, and I see them with my clients. And, you know, it's not an easy thing to do, but I'd say a little bit to my comment around the label is to have the courage to say something, because when we tolerate or let these behaviors go, we're implicitly allowing them. And so often in executive coaching mandates or mandates where, you know, we want to address certain behaviors, the first part is awareness. Often these folks are not aware and they're deeply suffering themselves. You know, in the description that I read, you know, so we see people that are very dedicated, that are under a lot of pressure as objectives get harder and harder. The pressure and the mental stress could lead to poor behaviors. So what are we putting in place, and what are we putting in place for those that are suffering? So I think that those are some of the practices we could look at in the psychological safe spaces ramble. I don't know, Mirella, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, I totally am aligned with you in that. On the one hand, deep respect and obviously compassion for the individual who is stuck and not quite sure how to move forward, in part because they rely on their job, they are afraid of what could happen to their careers. And in many cases, we've actually seen people who have given so much to their careers, and then they end up reporting to a manager that demonstrates these subclinical traits along the lines of callousness, lack of remorse, lack of responsibility. And so there is space for recognizing the suffering, and not a but, it's and. How do we move forward with what we know is possible? And you just said it, the hope is that companies start to recognize how important psychological safety is, not just as a concept, but what can we do to put in place in the workforce so that someone like this individual can find services around addressing it. You know, in the end, I want to leave this last thought. We're not responsible for what decisions people are going to make. We're not responsible for how they choose to show up. We are collectively responsible in saying no to behaviors. We are collectively responsible in pushing the boundaries and say it stops here, it ends here. Because as I mentioned earlier on, you know, Robert Hare and his writing is very clear, and thank you for that. I'm going to look into that book. There is something around not doing anything. Mm-hmm. And expecting the person to all of a sudden have an epiphany that they are responsible. In the case of psychopathy, which is subclinical traits to antisocial personality disorder, there's no sense of responsibility. So no softness will get that individual to change all of a sudden. It requires, you know, a multidimensional approach.
And also you mentioned this trait of charm and wanting to succeed. So if the rules of the game change for collaboration and cooperation, and that's what you need to demonstrate to succeed, then that encourages individuals to take on these behaviors, even if it is insincere it at least creates a workplace where these the behaviors that we want that are positive to creating positive outcomes will be more prevalent.
Yeah.
And is there another question? Okay, Mirella, do you want to take that one? Here's another anonymous question from Facebook. What can be done by companies to minimize hiring people with the characteristics or behaviors that organizations want to avoid? Oh, that's very good. How to do it from the onset?
So this is a really, really great question. Thank you so much for asking. My thoughts are everywhere. The first thing is what I've noticed. I've noticed that companies will assess for behaviors that they don't want. So if we were to take a look at the dark triad, we already know now, well, you all know now that there is a Machiavellian aspect to it. There is the capacity to problem solve, capacity to refrain, capacity to set goals, capacity to show tremendous strategic thinking ability. So if we are going to assess for the behaviors that we don't want, we're looking at more of the other side, the callousness, a lack of empathy and so forth. And some companies will stress looking for those things, lack of. And then they might throw in what we want, which is goal setting and strategic thinking, but that in itself doesn't tell us anything about the individual. So I'm wondering that one approaches straight from the top, right? Not from the top, but from the very get-go. Let's assess for things we want to see. You know, Natalie, you talked about collaboration. You talked about team spirit. You also talked about psychological safety. Now, it is a concept that is used in groups, not necessarily me toward Natalie, because it's something that lives in a group. But you can definitely assess for the tendency, the desire, the motivation to create psychologically safe spaces. You could assess for that. Some people have that proclivity and others don't. Just like some people have the proclivity to put themselves in someone else's shoes before they open their mouth. You could look at those proclivities and those tendencies. And so let's assess for those things. And the hope is that by assessing for those things, we are going to weed out the individuals that may have subclinical traits that match the dark triad.
You know, I wonder if having some case studies and then having people put their perceptions of what's going on, and then you could really get to see what they're thinking.
Oh, I like that.
Or how they're interpreting a situation. Right. Then you could pick up on the empathy or lack of empathy, that maybe they were just looking at the outcome and the results and not the impact on the individual.
Oh, that's good. I like that one. Yes.
Wow. Oh my God, I'm looking at the time. This I could really spend a whole hour with you.
Me too.
This.
Me too with you, Nat.
And yeah. I hope that you will look at the resources that we will put online, because as you start to unpack this, as I mentioned, there's 300 books, but there's so many articles. And so you have to be really mindful and pick up the points that Mirella mentioned about when you're looking at a study, looking at the number of participants, who were they, and how it was done. And so I want to thank you for being there, wherever you are. Oh, there's one more question here. Some of the traits you discuss are actually appreciated in the business world. How can we change this narrative? Oh, can we squeeze a quick answer in here? Yeah. So we mentioned that some of the practices, I think it goes around to limits. So what's the limit between being dedicated, or if I look back at my descriptor, a tireless worker with incredible focus and problem-solving skills, being well-liked. So being well-liked, is it about being a chameleon and adjusting your the way you are and tolerating inappropriate behavior because you want to be liked? Being well-liked is wonderful. You know, being dedicated is great. But I think it's like measuring things on a continuum, that when something gets overuse, you know, we often look at this. So it's a strength, but what's the overuse of charm, or the overuse of being a strategic thinker? So where is the focus? Yeah. So I think that's perhaps one angle to look at.
I do agree. And then there's the other idea of a response versus react. You know, react is impulse in the moment, And all of these three that make up the dark triad have it. Impulse is there, even though the Machiavellian is more impulse control, but they tend to react. Whereas response or responding with care requires you to step back, think carefully about your own thinking, consider the impact of your own thinking, and then move to action. And none of these three that make up the dark triad can do that. And if they do that, they're not necessarily taking time to respond. They are reacting based on whatever it is that they've set their minds to go and get. And usually it has everything to do with acquisitions of things and what people, what more can people give them. So, yeah.
We're back to self-awareness.
So right.
How to raise self-awareness and then self-regulation, regulating emotions, regulating impulses.
Greed, totally. Yeah.
Thank you for that last question. So I think we're out of time.
And we are.
So I want to thank everyone again for being here. And please visit GranHeronInternational.com, where you can find this episode and others as well that you can download at no cost to you. So special thanks to GHI colleagues, especially Stefano, who worked tirelessly at making this show possible. And this is Natalie Doré, and you've been listening to Let's Rumble, brought to you by Gran Heron International.
Thank you, Natalie. Thank you, everyone.
We'll see you all next month.
Bye.